Well, the 1400s is not a particularly happy century in church history. It was kind of a period of decline. I think coming after the high point of the 13th century, which is the 1200s, with St. Thomas and the exuberance of discovering the Near East, discovery of Aristotle, the foundation of the new mendicant orders. Nevertheless, it's an interesting century. Some major figures in it. We're all familiar with Joan of Arc. Did you see the movie? Which one?
The first one.
I don't know if it's the first one or not, but the one with Lili Sobieski? Oh, the first one. No, I don't know that one. Yeah. But they it was like two of them came out the same year. Is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't see that one. I'd like to see that. I remember her from Fifth Element.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, Joan of Arc is here. 1425. She's 13 years old. She starts to hear voices. And within 3 years, she feels she has received a mission to lead the French troops. She goes to where the army is, dressed in soldierly dress, begins leading the troops, 1429. By the end of the year, most of the territories that the French had lost to the British had been recouped. And Charles VII had been crowned at Rouen. In 1430, she's captured by the British, imprisoned for 18 months, put on trial. The fellow who's in charge of the trial is Cardinal Cochon. He wants to be Pope, and he needs English support for that. So he was played by Peter O'Toole in the Lili Sobieski version. Joan is found guilty, of course, of heresy, and is burned at the stake. Now that's 1431, so in 1455, which would be about 24 years, 25 years later, they give her a retrial, posthumously. It's called the Process de Réhabilitation at Paris, and she's found not guilty. The charge of heresy, which leaves Benedict XV free in 1920 to canonize her. So she is a canonized saint.
Is that an isolated incident?
Is what an isolated incident?
The recanonization after
Oh my goodness. I don't know of other instances, but you make me remember a very peculiar case that happened in the 980s. There was a pope whose name started with the letter F. And I can't think of his name. It's not Fulgentius, but something like that. He had died, and the fellow who became pope after him belonged to the opposing family of Roman nobles. So this new pope had the old pope's bones dug up, and they put the skeleton on a witness stand in a courtroom and actually had a lawyer talking to the bones and saying, "Did you not so-and-so?" And they found the guy guilty, even though he's just a set of bones. And so they took all the bones apart and threw them in the Tiber River. This is a pope we're talking about. Isn't that amazing? So, now that was a trial after his death. I wish I could think of his name. Dark Ages, dead center of the Dark Ages, the 900s. Yeah, something else. Gutenberg invents printing. I think in the preceding handout, didn't we have 1447 as the invention of movable type, and then 1456, I think it was the Gutenberg Bible. So it's around 1450. There ought to be a C period in front there. 1453, a major thing happens, and that is the Muslims conquer the Byzantine Empire. Byzantine Empire, you'll recall, is the eastern half of the Roman Empire that had survived the barbarian invasions back in the 300s, 400s. But now it finally ends. The Byzantine Empire is actually 395 to 1453, which is more than 1,000 years. That's amazing that it survived. Also, cultural background in the 1400s. In 1492, somebody sailed the ocean blue, yeah? But besides that, a couple of other famous things happened in Spain, all in the same year. Did you see the movie 1492? Yeah? One concerns the Moors. The Moors, which means Moroccans, in other words, Muslims, who had crossed from Northwest Africa to Spain in 711 and conquered Spain, had been in charge of Spain from 711 all the way through up to the 1400s, so that's 700 years. But in 1492, the Reconquista occurs, the reconquest, and the Christians of Spain under Ferdinand and Isabella are able to push the Moors back out of Spain. And then Ferdinand and Isabella move their royal court to the Alhambra, which had been Spanish court, Muslim court. Also, in 1492, concerning the Jews, Ferdinand and Isabella give Jews in their realm the choice of converting or leaving. I have figures here. Where is it? There it is. About 50,000 decide to stay and convert to Christianity. About four times that number, three or four times that number, decide to leave. Torquemada. Yeah. True. And we're going to see Spanish Inquisition here in a second. Various Jews had converted prior to 1492, often, it seems, not so much out of conviction, but in order to advance themselves in court and have certain preferences in employment and that sort of thing. Jews who converted in the Middle Ages were known as Marranos, which means pigs. Nobody knows why that term got used. I heard an explanation which was not really pejorative. I mean, it wasn't really a put-down the way we think it would be, though I can't recall what the explanation was. And I think it was primarily to judge the genuineness of conversions to Christianity by Jews that the Spanish Inquisition was founded. Maybe. Yeah, that's true. Or she said maybe it's because Jews couldn't eat pork, and now that they've converted to Christianity, one sign of their conversion would be that they now eat pigs. Yeah, maybe. That's as good a guess as any. And then, of course, the third event for the Spanish in 1492 is the sailing of Columbus. Even though he's Italian, he sails under Spanish flag and does so with the help of Jewish finance. Lands in the Bahamas. Heresies in the 1400s. One heresy is called conciliarism. Conciliarism is from the word council. This refers to church councils. Actually, it refers to ecumenical councils, worldwide meetings of the bishops. We've seen in the past that these occur about once every 100 years, and there have been now 21 of them in church history. What conciliarism says is that the ultimate authority in the church is ecumenical councils, not the Pope. The Pope is less authoritative than a council, and therefore a council can overrule a pope. if a pope were to make a declaration and say it was infallible, a council later on could say, oh, he got that wrong. We're the ultimate authority. We can correct popes. This, of course, was a heresy because Catholicism believes in infallibility both of ecumenical councils and of popes. So this idea that you can appeal to a ecumenical council against a pope, it was the heart of conciliarism, because some people didn't like what popes said or did, and therefore they would say, well, you just wait till the next council. You know, you'll get your comeuppance. Certainly, right. Popes always participate. She asked if popes participate in ecumenical councils. Always in ecumenical councils. And they may, you know, in early centuries, it might be difficult for them to travel and forego jurisdictional duties, so they might send legates or representatives. But it has always been the case that an ecumenical council has been approved by the Pope. And if there is a council that meets and claims that it's ecumenical and doesn't wind up approved by the Pope, it's not an ecumenical council. I don't know if you remember, second or third evening, we had that meeting of, I think it was 250 or so bishops. That's a lot back then, 500s. But they were all Easterners, and they claimed that certain practices in the West were illegal, using unleavened bread and so on and so on. And the Pope refused to put his approval on it. Therefore, even though they had claimed at the time that this is an ecumenical council we're having, it wound up not being ecumenical. I'm sorry? They razed? Oh, raised. Yeah. I'm thinking of a council that occurred in the 500s, and you're thinking of the Fourth Crusade, where the army on its way to the Near East sacked Constantinople? Is that maybe what you're thinking? Or maybe you're thinking of the Iconoclast. There it is. Okay. Right. That's back in that period, 700s. All right, a council meets, ecumenical council, early in the 1400s. That's the Council of Constance. It condemns Wycliffe. We talked about Wycliffe last time. He was late 1300s. Wycliffe's ideas had passed to the University of Prague. We mentioned that last time. Although he himself was a professor at Oxford, the King of England married a princess of Bohemia, which is present-day Czech Republic, and this resulted in a trading of visiting professors between Oxford and the University of Prague, and therefore the University of Prague became infected, so to speak, with Wycliffe's ideas. In Czechoslovakia, this became Husism, because the main proponent of Wycliffe's ideas was a priest and professor whose name was John Hus, H-U-S-S. John Hus used Wycliffe's ideas, which are really a pre-Protestant form of Protestantism. He used these ideas for nationalistic purposes. He wanted to consolidate Czech resentment against Rome in order to cause an upsurge of patriotism, and this would cause the Czechs to defy Germany, which pretty much had control over them at the time. So he was given a guarantee of safe travel to and from the Council of Constance so that they could question him. This guarantee of safe travel was given by the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor. But once Hus got there, he was so defiant and aggressive that they decided not to let him off the hook, and they burned him at the stake. That's in 1415. So if you ever get invited to an ecumenical council, think about it. Another major accomplishment of the Council of Constance in the 1410s is the ending of the Western Schism. The term Western Schism refers to that period, 1307 to 1378, I believe it was, when first there were two popes, both claiming to be pope, and then later on, a council, a local council, tries to say, neither of you is pope, we're going to vote for a third one, but the other two didn't stop, and so you wound up with three popes. Well, the Council of Constance was a worldwide meeting of the bishops, and so they persuaded one of the three to forego his prerogatives. That's the one who was the true pope, by the way, recognized as true pope by present-day Catholicism. And the other two were deposed, the anti-popes, as we call them. And so they were able to elect a fresh pope, and since 1415 to the present, we've always had only one pope. Although I'm thinking about running, what the heck? Another ecumenical council occurred in the 1430s. That was the Council of Basel. It met in Basel, Switzerland. But because of the plague, they had to switch it to another town, which was Ferrara, and then again they switched it to Florence. So it's called the Council of Basel-Ferrara-Florence. Trouble is, even though the ecumenical council had moved on to Ferrara and then to Florence, a bunch of the bishops had stayed in Basel and continued to have a council there parallel with the one that the Pope's representatives were at. So this continuation of the Council of Basel is not recognized as an ecumenical council, and in fact, they passed decrees that were conciliarist. They affirmed that ecumenical councils are superior to popes. So that is not recognized by the Catholic Church because the council had moved on to these other locations, and therefore the decrees of the ones who stayed at the Council of Basel are null and void. A last accomplishment that one finds at the Council of Basel, Ferrara, Florence is reconciliation of the Eastern Orthodox. This is the second time that we've reconciled them. We reconciled with them at the Council of Lyon in the 1300s. Now here it is, 1439, we create a decree of union to which the leaders of the Greek Orthodox, the Byzantine Emperor, the Patriarch of Constantinople, etc., subscribe. They agree to it. But once again, when they get back to the East, the populace refuses to go along with it. They're still angry. Here's the Spanish Inquisition. Top of page 2. 1478. Sixtus IV authorizes the Spanish Inquisition to investigate the sincerity of Jewish converts. So now that's prior to 1492 when this ultimatum was given, convert or leave. So the investigation of conversions means the Maranos, the ones who had converted in the 1200s, 1300s, early 1400s. Sixtus IV appoints the Dominican Tomás de Torquemada as Inquisitor General. Toward the end of the century, as we talk about heresies, we come to Girolamo Savonarola. Savonarola was a Franciscan. I don't know if you'll recall our discussion of the dispute that arose within the Franciscans, really almost as soon as Francis died. Half of the Franciscans said you got to abide by Francis's rule to the letter, which means you can't even own a toothbrush or a pair of socks. And the others said, well, that's an ideal that we're supposed to live up to, but, you know, we're supposed to have enough possessions to do our pastoral work and so on. So you had the observants, or the ones who observed the rule rigorously, or the spirituals, as they were called, versus the conventuals. Conventuals being the ones who live together in community in a conventus. Well, Savonarola is one of these fiery spiritual Franciscans. He thinks everybody to be a good Christian has to be severely self-denying and ascetical. You should whip yourself every night and so on. So, although it's argued whether he was genuinely heretical or merely pressed for devotional practices as if everyone must do them, and it's not the case that everyone has to, he nevertheless was burned at the stake in Florence in 1498. Renaissance architecture gets going. Renaissance architecture is a return to Greco-Roman architecture. So think of the Parthenon, and you've got Renaissance architecture. This suddenly became very fashionable to imitate the old Greek temples and so on, which goes right along with the renewed interest in Greek dramas and Roman historians and that whole, you know, Renaissance means rebirth, that whole rebirth of interest in the classical world, in antiquity. Religious orders and missions. The Benedictines reform themselves. On the next page, the Dominicans reform themselves. The Franciscans reform themselves. Here's John of Capistrano. If you ever wonder why that island off the coast of California, San Juan Capistrano, St. John of Capistrano, where the birds return. What kind of bird is it? I thought birds return there every spring. It's not a what? Oh, it's not an island. Oh, I thought it was. Okay, there you go. Catalina's the island, yeah. Swallows. Yeah, that's right, right. So that mission would have been named San Juan Capistrano because the Franciscan missionaries were in California. And he's a Franciscan reformer, makes sense. What, you don't approve of reforms?
No, no.
No, why?
What was there to reform?
Well, take a look at the very first sentence of our handout. 1300s to 1400s. Symptoms of decline and decay are evident in ecclesiastical life generally. There is a neglect of discipline and of spiritual and intellectual effort. So the real leaders in the religious orders are trying to pull their fellows up and say, you know, stop laying around watching TV. We're supposed to be doing something. Here we also, in the middle of page 3, we also come across the final split between the conventuals and the observants among the Franciscans. That finally occurs in 1517, but it was on its way throughout the 1400s. Also, the Carmelites undergo a split between the rigorists and the more moderate Carmelites. So you wind up with observant Carmelites and conventual Carmelites. The observant ones are called discalced, which is from a Latin word that means unshod, not wearing sandals. Barefoot Carmelites. Teresa of Avila, St. John of the Cross, in the mid-1500s, are discalced Carmelites. Jerry?
Got it. Spiritual?
Savonarola?
Right.
Oh, I thought he was quite loud. Right. No, I think there's more to it than that. For one thing, he wasn't just saying, like his fellow spiritualists were, that we spiritualists ought to be rigorous in our asceticism. Savonarola was saying all Christians everywhere have to be rigorous, rigorously ascetic, self-denying. All Christians everywhere should have no possessions, should walk around barefoot, etc. Whereas the evangelical counsels of celibacy, poverty, and obedience that one finds in Jesus' teachings are said to be, if you would be perfect, do these. But Jesus never said you had to. They're not commands, they're counsels. So that distinguished him from the other spiritualists. He also had the audacity of saying to the leaders, the political leaders in Florence, was it still the Medicis at this time? Late 1400s? I think it was. Of telling them that they're not good Christians and they got to shape up. So that'll get you burnt. Sacraments, bottom of page 3. Frequency of masses are still very rare. We saw this in the last 2 or 3 centuries. Many priests rarely celebrate mass in the 1300s. In 1314, a synod of Ravenna required priests to say mass at least once a year. 3 years later, the synod of Tarragona upped it to 3 times a year. 1324, the Synod of Toledo required priests to say Mass at least 4 times a year. But frequency of reception is very rare also. The laity don't really think of the Eucharist so much as helping one to advance in virtue as something kind of spooky, something they're awed by and don't feel worthy of coming near. Eucharistic legends are numerous in the 1300s, 1400s. Bleeding hosts, hosts that are trapped in a building on fire and come out without any mark, and so on. The Immaculate Conception, we've mentioned before, was pushed by the Franciscans in the 1300s and was denied by the Dominicans. But here we see it becomes more widespread. Finally, in the 1600s-1700s, it becomes universal, which leads the way for the definition of it in 1854. Indulgences, we've mentioned before, but the 1400s are really the period of rampant indulgences. After the Council of Constance, indulgences start to increase very quickly. They're granted for all kinds of things. If you contribute to a church building or repair of a church, you get an indulgence. If you visit a certain altar or take a certain pilgrimage, you get an indulgence. If you venerate relics, if you aid a crusade, fight against the Hussites or the Turks or the Saracens, if you recite certain prayers, if you promote hospitals and other public works, you get an indulgence. So they become extremely common. Now the good news is that most theologians taught the correct doctrine about indulgences. And indulgences originally, first half of the 1400s, let's say, had a good effect, just as they had had in the 11, 12, 1300s. Here's a quotation from Bielmeyer. There can be no doubt that indulgences had a generally good effect. They reminded the faithful of the seriousness of sin and the necessity of atoning for it. They induced people to receive the sacraments more frequently and promoted works of Christian charity and public welfare. The practice was productive of great spiritual and even of material good. Many magnificent churches, works of art, and charitable institutions would never have materialized without this encouragement. Then you flip the page and you get the bad news. Abuses of indulgences appear especially toward the end of the Middle Ages. Churchmen frequently complain of overabundant indulgences and excessive grants. Boniface IX, for example, around 1400, and the Curia at that time stress the financial rewards of pushing indulgences. City magistrates and kings start granting indulgences. They want in on the proceeds, and they don't want the money all flowing to Rome. Many preachers of indulgences and collectors of money offerings commit the worst abuses. Spurious documents purporting to grant excessive indulgences appeal to the superstitious. So, by 1500, things are in such a state that if we look only at the small town where Luther lived, which was Wittenberg, here's the situation. Each relic at the castle church of Wittenberg was, when displayed, worth an indulgence of 100 years. Since there were lots of relics, and since they were displayed 7 times a year, the annual total was about 2 million years worth of indulgences. The people who go and view the relics. The idea of indulgences for the dead is our next topic, in fact. In the 1200s, theologians begin to acknowledge that it's possible for indulgences to be applied to the dead, per modum suffragii, by way of suffrage, to support the people in purgatory. Around 1450, we have the earliest known papal indulgence on behalf of souls in purgatory. So those in 1500 could, by viewing the relics, either apply the benefits of the indulgences to themselves or ask God to apply them to those in purgatory. Writs of indulgence appear. This is where you can have a piece of paper granting you an indulgence that you can apply in the future. At first, they were restricted to people of high rank. Later on, anybody could buy one. These writs of indulgence start to refer to remissio peccatorum, which means remission of sins. And that is totally wrong. The church has never taught that indulgences remit your sins, cause God to forgive your sins. That's done in confession. And indulgences presuppose that the sins have been forgiven. They only deal with punishment for sins that may remain for sins that have been forgiven. painting in the late 1400s, early 1500s, a lot of people would say, reached the highest point it has ever been. Just take a look at some of these names. I don't know if they'll mean what to you what they do to me, because I had art history and I loved it. But Fra Angelico, Fra Filippo Lippi, Botticelli, Bellini, Titian, Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, Correggio, Raphael, Jan van Eyck, Albrecht Dürer, Matthias Grunewald, Hans Holbein. These are like the greatest artists ever, and they all congregate in this period of the Renaissance, around 1500. Sculpture too, especially Michelangelo. Devotional literature for the laity is very widespread in the late 1400s. There are catechisms, there are spiritual books with titles like Consolation of the Soul, The Way to Heaven, Spiritual Treasury. There are books of hours. These contained the permanent parts, unchanging parts of the Liturgy of the Hours that the monks say, but they're intended for the liturgy to pray along with them. Cultivation of the soul, that's hortulus animae, etc. Now we come to a quite interesting topic, 1500s, and that's the European witch craze. I debated about when to insert the European witch craze, because it doesn't start in 1500. It actually has its roots all the way back in 1300s and before. But I guess the craziness really reaches its height in the 1500s, so I decided to put it here. So we're going to go back a bit and look at some early concepts involved with the witch craze. Sorcery is from the Latin sortilegium, which means to read lots. When you read lots, that means that you're predicting the future. You're divining. It's like flipping coins, you know. If I get two tails and a head, that means such and such is going to happen. If I get two heads and a tail, that means such and such is going to happen. Sorcery, or divining the future, is not witchcraft. It's magic thinking, as is witchcraft, but it's not really the same as witchcraft. Augustine believed that sorcerers could perform miracles that saints could not do. So there's a belief in sorcery. It's especially strong in the German tribes that are converted in the 400s, 500s, 600s. But even in them, the church pretty much eradicates belief in sorcery by the time you get to the 1200s. So there's not a witchcraft problem in the church in the 1200s. Except in Spain. In Spain, there's interest in sorcery. The University of Cordoba in the 1200s had daily lectures on astrology, study of the stars, necromancy. Necros means dead, so summoning dead spirits. Seances is necromancy. There's an instance of that in the Bible. Take a look at 1 Samuel chapter 28. A wise woman summons up the soul of Samuel. Pyromancy. Pyro is fire. And geomancy. Geos is Greek for earth. So geomancy is using spatial arrangements. They do that in Chinese religion. We call it feng shui. It's like that. Albert the Great, one of the great scholastic theologians, was a famous expert on alchemy and astrology. There is no chemistry, there is no astronomy as rigorous sciences. There's only this kind of mishmash of lore. And so he was a great scientist, but that's what was available in his day. He was the teacher of Thomas Aquinas. Alexander the Fourth, in the 1200s, distinguished between sorcery, which is divination, and heresy. And he said, heresy is what the Inquisition deals with, whereas if a case of sorcery comes to light, let the local bishop deal with that. It's not a big deal. Aquinas discusses magic in the Summa Theologica. And by the time you get to the 1300s, interest in magic is on the increase, just as interest in magic was virtually non-existent in 1850, but since then has gradually become of greater interest. By the time you get to 1900, you've got the spiritualists who are knocking tables and having ectoplasm show up in the room and so on. Nowadays, I mean, there's a real recrudescence of interest in astrology and these sorts of things. So it kind of goes in cycles, and we're in one of those cycles now. So, 1300, talismans, charms, are popular both at the papal court and at the courts of the European kings. Boniface the Eighth, Benedict the Eleventh, Clement the Fifth, all around 1300, are reported to have used talismans. Now we get into the 1300s, and this is really when witchcraft has its roots. John the 22nd was superstitious. He had a curved horn, like a cow horn or a ram's horn, that he would stick into his bread and sprinkle salt around it as a way of protecting himself from spells. Lo and behold, he discovered that somebody had put spells on him and on other members of the Curia in order to kill them, kind of like voodoo dolls. And of course, being a superstitious person, he's aghast at this. And so he orders the Inquisition to turn its attention to magic and sorcery. So from this point on, sorcerers are not just local silly people, as had been earlier thought, but instead they're now considered heretics. Witchcraft starts to show up in the manuals that are written as aids for inquisitors. The most famous manual for inquisitors was written by Bernard Huy. I believe he was a Franciscan. It briefly mentions divination, talks about horoscopes, talks about palmistry, talks about cartomancy. Cartos is card, is where we get the word card. So, tarot cards. According to Bernard Huy in his manual for inquisitors, an inquisitor should interrogate a suspect about traditional sorcery practices, like predicting the future, stealing hosts and oil, baptizing wax figures. Only once does he mention women who ride out at night. Even in the 1400s, six other manuals for inquisitors lack references to witchcraft. So it's got its roots in the 1300s, but it's very gradually starting to become a real concern, and doesn't really become a great concern till the later 1300s, 1400s. 1330 to 75, in Europe, there are 48 trials for magic, 47 by city courts, only one by the Inquisition. And in all of those, it's sorcery, except for one. Now we come to what I think is probably the great reason for the increase in witchcraft hysteria, and that's the death of one-third of your family. All throughout Europe, in the Black Plague, the Black Death, from 1348 to 1351, within a 3-year period, one-third of Europe dies. So if each of us had one third of our family die, we'd all be rather hysterical. And we'd all be worried about supernatural powers causing terrible things to happen to us. And we'd probably be looking for scapegoats. So the mood turns dark and paranoid. 1398, the University of Paris Theology Department adopts 28 articles on witchcraft. They affirm the necessity of a pact with the devil in order for magic to be successful. Well, that's going to fuel the fire of suspicion, because if somebody is dabbling in magic or suspected of dabbling in magic, automatically the presumption will be that they have a pact with the devil. Why else would they be trying magic? That's the only way to make it work. Trials for diabolism intensify. Municipal courts, city courts adopt inquisition techniques. We know what those are from last time. Municipal courts no longer require informers to substantiate allegations. Previously, false accusers were sometimes drowned, which tended to keep people from accusing one another. 1400s, treatises on witchcraft. From 1320 to 1420, which is 100 years, there are only 13 treatises on witchcraft. But from 1435 to 1486, which is half that length of time, there are 28 treatises on witchcraft, twice as many in half the time. That shows you the parabolic rise of interest and concern about witches, but it also shows the effect that printing had, because printing is invented around 1450. So it's much easier now to disseminate these ideas. There are over 100 witch trials in the last two-thirds of the 1400s, though many are still just for sorcery. But new charges are now appearing. So we're getting into the heart of the witchcraft craze here in the second half of the 1400s. Here's some of the charges. Night meetings of witches, sometimes hundreds of witches gathering together. Witches riding out to meetings. Why do witches ride broomsticks? I mean, why not ride goats or frogs? It's a common tool of the peasant woman. That's true. I also think it's a phallic symbol. Ritual feasting with sexual orgies. People start accusing each other of. Ritual murder of children. Shape-shifting. I remember taking a walk one night along some railroad tracks. It was moonlit, beautiful moonlit night. And all at once, I heard something clacking toward me. And I looked, I could see this kind of white fuzzy thing. And I went up a little closer, it was a goat. And I just kind of froze. Even now, our culture has these associations of goats with demons. You know, the goat head and the upside down pentagram looks like a goat head, and so on. So demons appear as goats, wolves, dogs, cats, pigs, birds. You don't know if the bird you're looking at is a demon or not. It's a paranoid time. Descriptions of the devil become similar to what we have nowadays. Devils are red, devils have tails, devils have horns. Pacts with the devil are rarely mentioned in the 1400s. That's a later development. There's one reference prior to 1500 to the parodying of church services, what we now refer to as a black mass. But nothing like the black mass. That is a literary invention of the 19th century. The witch's Sabbath. In 1475, we have our first specific reference to such a thing. Sabbaths are at night, usually at midnight. They're on Thursdays, later on any day. Why Thursday, I wonder? I have no idea. It's Thor's day, so it's got pagan connotations, but most of the days of the week refer back to German religion, paganism. Meetings are in woods, fields, cemeteries, ruins, houses or churches. Sabbaths are mostly emphasized in Germany and Switzerland. In 1484, you have a major turning point in the frenzy. A notching up of the frenzy occurs when the Pope, Innocent VIII, puts out a bull. It condemns witchcraft and heresy in Germany, in the Rhine Valley. It appoints a couple of Dominicans, Heinrich Krama and Jakob Sprenger, as inquisitors to root out witchcraft in Germany. And in fact, these two guys had gone to the Pope and asked for this bull to be promulgated so that they could do this. The bull is often used by historians to mark the beginning of the witchcraft craze. 2 years later, these two Dominican inquisitors publish a book. It's a manual for inquisitors on how to deal with witchcraft. It's called the Malleus Maleficarum. Maleficarum means malicious, malevolent, bad. And Malleus means hammer. So hammer of witches. It's usually translated. I actually have a copy in my office. It's very interesting reading. It provides a complex demonological model, such as we have listed there at the top of the page. It blames sorcery almost entirely on women, which is very sad because this results in deaths of hundreds of women in the next century. It does not mention familiar spirits. A familiar is an animal helper for a shaman in a primitive religion. Like if you go to the Amazon tribes, or if you go to the Kalahari Desert pygmies, those, or if you go to the outback where the aborigines are, some guy within the clan or the tribe will be the specialist in religion. And that guy is called a shaman. Shamans in primitive religions almost always have some kind of an animal helper. For example, do you remember the Simpsons episode where Homer Simpson eats some chili peppers? Now I can tell who's seen the Simpsons episode. Psychedelic atomic chili peppers. And he goes on this trip, and while he's on this trip, which he imagines himself to be out in the American Southwest desert, a coyote comes up and talks to him and is his helper, kind of gets him back to where he belongs. Time for some Simpsons trivia. Can anybody tell me who provided the voice for that coyote? No? It's the guy that they made the movie about. He always dresses in black. Plays a guitar.
Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash. Yeah, Johnny Cash. Okay.
With those associations with the Aborigines and the Amazon, there's some reference also probably hallucinogenic drugs also. With those references, the Aborigines and the Amazon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most primitive groups, most groups that are still practicing hunter-gatherer economies, where the men hunt and the women scrounge for vegetation, use various methods for their shamans to contact the supernatural half of reality. And sometimes it's a hallucinogenic drug. There's a frog in South America, which, if you boil it, its skin puts out the most powerful hallucinogenic we know of. Ancient India, the Hindus used a drink called soma, which was made from a mushroom. Peyote with the Yaqui Indians, and so on. At any rate, familiar spirits. What is the familiar spirit for a witch? A black cat, exactly. So that's what we're talking about here when it says that the Malleus Maleficarum does not mention familiar spirits. It does not mention the obscene kiss. I've never heard of that. Does anybody know about that? Sabbat orgies or the devil's mark. Now that I've heard of. Didn't they talk about that in the Crucible? Some of the girls who were accused of being witches, or some of the old women who were accused of being witches at the Salem witch trials in the 1600s in near Boston, their bodies were examined to see if they had some kind of an unusual birthmark or something, which would be attributed to the sign that they had made a pact with the devil. But all of these are later characteristics. 1500s to 1700s. Up to the 1500s, most charges of witchcraft involved folk doctors and wise women, and they were prompted by jealousy and anger. Wise women know arcane herbs that harm as well as cure, herbs like deadly nightshade or henbane. Statistics. Between 1500 and 1700, the estimate is that somewhere between 200,000 and a million people, mostly women, died in the witchcraft craze. That's why I put all of this right here in the 1500s, even though it goes back prior and goes on beyond. The men were in charge. Sociologists have done studies on this, I've heard, but I haven't read them myself, as to why mostly women. And it has to do with their position in society and that sort of thing. But I don't know the details, sorry. Protestantism and the witchcraft craze. Luther, Zwingli, another Protestant leader, and Calvin all believed in the Sabbat and in night flights, just as firmly as any 15th century inquisitor. Under Calvin's successor at Geneva, a fellow named Theodore Beza, 91 women and 8 men were executed for witchcraft. Of the women, 45 were widows and 14 were spinsters. Witches are mostly poor. The men are mostly old and handicapped, or criminals, or witches' relatives. 1692 was the witchcraft trials at Salem, 14 miles northeast of Boston, and there 20 people were put to death. The Crucible is that play by, was it Henry Miller? Arthur Miller. A very well done movie. You ought to rent it if you haven't seen it. Anthropology considers witchcraft a social strain gauge. Witchcraft reached its peak at the maximum moment of wrenching between a medieval worldview and that of a recognizably modern Europe between the years 1570 and 1630. Now, that's an interesting thought. You know, the whole Western Hemisphere is moving from medievalism to modernism, and that causes a lot of anxiety. So maybe that's a cause. Well, this brings us to heresies of the 1500s. And of course, that's Protestantism, is the main heresy of the 1500s. So we begin with Martin Luther, Now, we've already seen that there's predecessors for Martin Luther. There's Wycliffe in the 1300s. He dies in 1383. There's Hus in the 1400s. He dies in 1415. There's the Waldensians who got going in the 1200s. All of them taught similar doctrines to what Luther is going to teach. Emphasis on the Bible, de-emphasis on church and a church's institution and on sacraments and so on. But Luther showed up at that moment when the forces were right for such a movement to be capable of rending Christendom apart. Luther's life. He's born in 1483. His father is a miner, digs in a mine. The father was very frugal and saved his small wages to the point where he was able to buy his own copper mine. That was successful, so by the time Luther was in his teenage years, his father was a self-made man and was one of the recognized pillars of the community. There's a good evidence that the dad was also extremely harsh with his children. Luther was physically abused as a child and pretty badly. Did I put that in here? Yeah, I did. There it is. Luther suffers from scrupulosity as a young adult, presumably because he endured physical abuse. His father beat him at home. Of his parents, he later wrote, they did not understand the art of adjusting their punishments. His teachers beat him in school. One time, Luther was caned 15 times in one morning for not having mastered the tables of Latin grammar. Perhaps because of the abuse, the question of certainty under God, being loved by God, am I certain that he approves of me, drove him to confess his sins so frequently to his fellow monks that they became annoyed with him. There were moments when Luther hated God. Jerry, got a question back there. The statement that quotes Luther concerning his parents is from a four-volume History of Philosophy by Alexander Jones. When you receive the handout at our 10th lecture, it will have, at the very end, a set of a couple dozen reference works with full bibliographical data. And so there you can just look for Jones and find what his book is. Go to that page and you'll find it. That he was physically abused? Well, the second quotation from Kittelsen. Kittelsen is a extremely committed Lutheran who wrote a biography of Luther. So, as far as I know, it's recognized by everybody. Now, that he was physically abused. The question whether that led to his scrupulosity is another matter. The chief exponent of that theory is a psychologist back in the mid-1900s named Erik Erikson. Anybody ever heard of him? You've heard of him. He wrote a book on Luther, analyzing him psychologically, and suggesting that it was this physical abuse that led to his hatred of God because he identified God with his father and so on. A dramatist picked up on this book by the psychologist, Erik Erikson. The dramatist's name was Osborne. Who is that? You might know his first name. He's kind of famous, but I can't think of other works he's done. Anyway, he wrote a play, which he called Luther, based upon this theory of Erik Erikson. And that was made into a movie. This is our night for movies, I guess. It was made into a movie called Luther. Stacy Keach played Luther. If you know him, he's the guy with the hair lip. But not to be confused with Joaquin Phoenix, right? Mike Hammer, you remember that series? That was Stacy Keach. Anyway, so it's been around. And as far as I know, most people accept this idea. Even if you don't want to argue that his scrupulosity resulted from the physical abuse, it's unquestionable that he was scrupulous. Scruple means undue anxiety about correctness of one's behavior. So if I'm scrupulous, then I'll have a kind of obsessive compulsive fixation on everything I do, and I'll be asking, was that a sin that I didn't say good morning as he passed? You know, or, oh my gosh, I'm eating and I forgot to wash my hands. I gotta go to confession. It's that kind of thing that we're talking about with scrupulosity. Scrupulosity was well recognized in moral theology and Catholicism long before Luther, as a condition and how to deal with it and so on. Luther joined, you can see it there at the top, the observant Augustinians, the religious orders that had adopted the rule of St. Augustine, had also split into the more rigorous and the less rigorous, and Luther joined up with the more rigorous. He had a spiritual advisor, Father Staupitz, S-T-A-U-P-I-T-Z, who would try to ease Luther's anxieties and compulsions, and would say to him, Luther, come on, relax. It says right here, God is love, you know, 1 John 4:8. Says right here, God even loves his enemies. He gotta love you, Matthew 5:47. So this saintly spiritual advisor, spiritual director that Luther had, one of his fellow monks, tried to work with him, but it didn't help. His scrupulosity continued. It did not, however, interfere with Luther's academic advancement. Luther was a brilliant guy. He got his bachelor's, he got his master's, he got his PhD in theology, and then he was sent by his order to the town of Wittenberg. There was a newly founded university at Wittenberg. It had only been founded in 1502. So about 10 years later, Luther is sent by his order to Wittenberg, actually to finish his PhD in theology, but also to teach. And what was needed at that time was somebody to teach the Bible rather than systematic theology or moral theology or something else. So Luther specialized in scripture. He gave lectures on Genesis, he gave lectures on Psalms, he gave lectures on the Gospels, he gave lectures on Romans. It was when he was doing his lectures on Romans, 1513s, that he apparently had a breakthrough insight. He talks about this not at the time, but later on in the 1530s, when he's becoming an old man, he reflects back on his life, and he talks about this experience that he had one night. When he was sitting in his cell, and he was reading Romans chapter 3, verses 21 to 31, Anybody got a Bible? I should have thought to bring one. Can we find one real quick? Yeah. Thanks. This breakthrough insight that he has one night as he's studying Romans, preparing lectures on Romans, is generally referred to as the Tower Experience. Scholars have investigated, and there doesn't seem to have been a tower involved. He was just sitting in his monk's cell studying. But I think it's called the Tower Experience because it's a peak experience, as they say nowadays. Thank you. Well, that's service. You even looked it up. Romans chapter 3, verses 21 to 31. But now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law, though testified to by the law and the prophets. The righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. For there is no distinction. All have sinned and are deprived of the glory of God. They are justified freely by His grace through the redemption in Christ Jesus, whom God set forth as an expiation through faith by His blood to prove His righteousness because of the forgiveness of sins previously committed. Through the forbearance of God, to prove His righteousness in the present time, that He might be righteous and justify the one who has faith in Jesus. What occasion is there then for boasting? It is ruled out. On what principle? That of works? No, rather on the principle of faith. For we consider that a person is justified by faith apart from works of the law. Does God belong to Jews alone? Does He not belong to Gentiles too? Yes, also to Gentiles. For God is one and will justify the circumcised on the basis of faith and the uncircumcised through faith. Are we then annulling the law by this faith? Of course not. On the contrary, we are supporting the law. This is the passage that caused Luther's breakthrough. And I don't know if you noticed, but in these 11 verses, there are 9 references to faith. Did you hear how often that was there? The word is used 8 times, and then there's a reference to all who believe. So Luther came across this emphasis in Paul on justification by faith. And justification is one of the words that Paul uses to mean turning from being at odds with God to being a friend of God. One turns from being an enemy of God to being a friend of God. It's not the only word that Paul uses to describe that conversio. Another word that he uses is expiation, the Greek root means to wipe away. He also uses the word redemption for this process of turning to God. That's a metaphor taken from the freeing of slaves in the Roman Empire. Your slave could come to you having saved his earnings and buy his freedom. Or someone else who has become a friend with the slave could come to you, the owner, and purchase that person's freedom. That's redemption. That's what redemption meant in the Roman Empire, and that's what Paul uses as a metaphor. It's like we're slaves, and Jesus has paid the price for our freedom. Another word that's used by Paul is salvation, Greek word is sozo, which basically means to return to health in all its fullness. So there's lots of different metaphors, about eight or so, that Paul uses for this process of going from being at odds with God to being at one with God. English speakers in the Middle Ages took that preposition, at one, and stuck a noun ending on it and came up with at one meant. Atonement is another way of expressing this change that occurs. However, since the passage that caused Luther's realization uses the term justification several times, that's the term that Luther latches onto, and he almost exclusively refers to justification, at least proportion, by a large proportion of the time. So what exactly was the nature of this realization? Well, it was the realization that Luther did not have to earn God's love. He did not have to earn his salvation. That in fact, all we have to do is believe. Justification is by faith. Believe in God. Believe in God's redemption of us, salvation of us through Christ, and you're already saved. This is a true insight. This coheres with Catholicism. We argue that we're saved by faith. The big difference came in Luther's decision or interpretation of this and similar passages. You can find the same idea in Galatians 2:16, for example, saved by faith, justification by faith. The difference came with Luther's misunderstanding that we're saved by faith alone. And over and over again, he says this in his writings. Justification is by faith alone. This became the slogan, one of the slogans for the Reformation. Sola fide, faith alone. The problem is that nowhere in Paul does he ever say that we're saved by faith alone. Yes, he says that we're saved by faith, but he never says we're saved by faith alone. He also talks about the importance of good works. That's something we can discuss next time. Luther took this insight that we're justified by faith alone and let it be the foundation of his reform. And it really is, even today, the foundation of the Reformation and foundational to Protestantism. What he did with this insight, how it all unfolded, how he wind up at odds with Catholicism, that's all stuff that we're going to do next time. And as well as the other leaders of the Reformation, Calvin, and so on. Good. Thank you all.